Well, hi everyone. I'm Jeanette Bishops. I'm an independent curator, and I've been working on a project called Performance Talks. And in addition, I've been hosting book clubs because I wanted to, as an independent curator and not having a space to work at, wanted to bring people together from the dance world and the visual art world and whoever is interested in performance and dance to just like gather and like talk about performance. So I've been interviewing people like just artists, dancers, choreographers, writers, curators, estate directors, about mainly the afterlives of performance. Kind of coming from institutional background, I felt like the visual art world still doesn't really have a lot of discourse around how to talk about performance, how to integrated in institution or not, and just like kind of the many ways that performance can live on, and to historicize performance, etc. And I spoke to David about his modern dance series publication, a series of monographs on contemporary choreographers that was published by MoMA. And this book, one of the three, the other two are on Ralph Lemon and the other one is Boris Karmets. And this book really stood out to me, and I had such a lovely conversation with David about this, and I wanted this conversation to be able to do it live with other people. So please also like chime in. It's not just us talking. And then Niall and I know each other,
not even that long,
but we had a really lovely studio visit and we were kind of geeking out about the book. The interesting thing is both of us have not seen Sarah's work live before. I was introduced to it by this book and I was allowed to see some footage in an archive somewhere. And Niall,
sight unseen, no archival footage, just essays and vibes is all I know.
And David obviously is very well known with her work. So David, I first want to have you introduce yourself a bit because I know you mostly of your former role as editor-in-chief at Art Forum. And I was only recently introduced to your writing, and I was kind of creepy in like looking at your Instagram. It's like who is David? Like I'm just gonna scroll back, and I saw some photos of you dancing as a boy, and I read this. It's a little boy, and I was like, okay, it's like he's a dancer himself. I was just like very curious why he was so drawn to dance as a writer. And I saw this interview with you about kind of your early days as a dancer in New York. And we spoke a bit about it. So I think it would be nice as an introduction if you can talk a bit about like what made you so interested in writing about dance and kind of how you started writing about dance. Maybe also, you know, in your early days at Art Forum, where you were like kind of covering events first and kind of moved from there?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot there. I moved to New York in 2002 and I had no idea what I was doing, but I went out every night when I was here. I like went out to clubs. It was just the thing that I did and I loved to dance. I couldn't speak to exactly why that is, but yeah, it's always been very much a part of what I've done socially. And I have a friend, Kim Brandt, who's a choreographer who also was here at that time. And she saw me when I was like dancing at clubs and was like, I want to put you in my dances. So she was making dances at the time. The funny thing is I'm like a very good club dancer, but it doesn't translate to a stage at all. Like it's not.
What kind of dances was she making?
Downtown dance, like, which is like this funny category that I try to unpack in the book, whatever that is. So it was, you know, it's a mix of different kinds of flavors of modern, like the things that she studied like in school, from Graham to Cunningham to Brown to like, you know, what have you, mixed with all the other stuff going on. But that's the thing, it's like every dance, as I try to go into in the book, like Balanchine was also doing this, like Cunningham's also doing this. Everybody's mixing these different kinds of forms. That's how you get the invention of new forms. So it's not like it was novel to be doing that. It's not like it's like modern or postmodern or anything. Anyways, she like saw me dancing, tried to put me on stage. I was not gifted in that way. But I got to see inside of the making of dances a lot over many different years with her. And this is before I started writing about art. It was before I was in the art world. In fact, I think the first thing I wrote ever was for Movement Research Journal. And it was a terrible piece that I hope has disappeared. But it was about improvisation.
Wake it up.
And trying to like figure out how to do improvisation in writing and in dance in a way that would be married. So I guess that was like an early iteration of all of this. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the question of like, the formation of this book came out of me seeing Sarah, and we have to like say that Sarah's in the room hiding over there. So I'm sure that she'll, well, we'll call on her maybe at some point, or she'll interrupt. Hi, Sarah. But my friend Kim took me in 2005 to see this piece called Daylight that she did at Performance Space, New York, which was then called PS122. And I was like completely devastated by this piece. I was just like thrown like out of my body. And I went the next day and I bought another ticket to see it the next night. And then I bought another ticket to see it the next night. I was just like obsessed immediately. And then from then on, I just had to see everything she did. And there was something about that where as I grew as a writer and figured out what I was doing in these other realms, like I kept returning to like, how can I make an offering to this work that is like completely captivating me? How can I explain why I'm so turned by it? And then like that just unspooled into this project, which has like this material iteration, which is this very strange book, actually, I think. If anybody's read it, it's like, it's not usual.
Why does it feel strange to you?
Well, it's strange. So this was part of like a series, Ralph Lemon, Boris Sharmatz at MoMA. The idea was to do for, and I have to also give thanks to Kathy Halbreich, who's not here, but who is an incredible woman, incredible figure, who like created the conditions and invitations for doing work like this. Stuart Comer, who's also over there, who was leading the department that the book was housed in. So they made a home for it. But I wanted to create monographs. I wanted to make like scholarship that rose to the occasion of these incredible artists. Like in the visual art world, you have like any fucking artist can get a monograph. Like you just get a gallery and you get like, somebody will pay for a book and like, you know, not anybody, but like a certain class of artists easily gets monographs. A lot of them are really shitty. They're not like really thought through. They're just like basically spam for like marketing these books. But there is also a lot of like quality stuff that comes out of it, but there wasn't that happening in the dance world. And I was like, there are these artists who are just some of the greatest artists I've ever seen. And there's not that level of attention or that record for their work. And so like, what would it mean to try to do something like this? And the Sarah book was like, I mean, it's funny because, okay, there's like no images. This is like the thing that's striking in the series and also I think in dance books in general. And there are no images for a lot of reasons, but primarily because Sarah and I had a very intense conversation around what images could be in the book and whether you could properly represent the book or represent the work with these images. The images around Sarah's work, most of which are taken by Paula Court, who's a really legendary performance photographer, are like some of the most incredible images of dance ever made. Like they're like exquisite images and unlike anything you'll see. And so I was like, I mean, I spent like 100 hours probably building a database of these images, like reaching out to institutions that didn't, like they weren't collected anywhere. None of this was collected anywhere.
So she's also never published her work, Paula.
Paula's never published her work either. So I was like, I was like very gung-ho. I was like, we're gonna have like full color, like beautiful, like illustrated book, like lots of beautiful images. And then in one of the many conversations I had with Sarah about the book, Sarah was very resistant to the book from the get-go. And one of the primary, and she can speak to this better than I can, but what I took from it was that she had like very valid concerns around whether you could properly, whether it would be, well, first, how images, if you have text that points to images, that it's actually like this completely artificial relationship and it's like deceptive and makes you think that you're getting a picture of something you don't really. And she was like, the text should stand on its own, basically. She was like, if the text is good, it should stand on its own. And I fought her like a lot on it. We had many ideas for how images might live in the book in a way that felt sincere. One of which was like flying to the place where we were printing them and like sitting in the place and like stuffing each book with like a single photograph we would print out, you know, so each book would have a different photograph, but you could like get it like, I don't know, like collector's cards or something. But all of that ended up being too, A, like just too expensive or too labor intensive or just didn't really work. So in the end, we just did this kind of like, I think pretty punk thing of just not including any images.
Was there ever a moment that you were like, let's just not do this book? That's, I'm giving up.
No, I was like, I'm gonna do it. But there were many, I like pulled my hair out like many times in the making of it. It was definitely like not an easy thing to do, but that was like, with the embattlement, actually I think was part of what created this crucible through which the book emerged as it did. And this was kind of like, I think, cool object. It's weird to encounter it now. I haven't like looked at it for years. So I was like, I picked it up recently and I was like rereading parts of it and I was like, oh, this fucking slaps.
Yeah. Cool. When we spoke, I read some parts to you and you were like, oh yeah, I haven't seen this writing in years. So I haven't, heard it.
But I'm curious, I want to know what Niall's relationship to it is and like how you encountered it. Like, how did it come to you?
I found it in a used bookstore at Light Industry, but I moved to New York in 2017 and had this like unnerving feeling that I had just missed something. Or was like, I feel like it was like, we used to have fun. We used to make dances and now we are here. And then it was 2017 into 2020 and like COVID and all those things. But I had this like feeling that there was like a artistic conversation that I was just catching the tail end of. That I was like, so I was like perpetually just like kind of doing this like fact-finding mission of trying to figure out like what I had just missed.
That's what I felt like.
Yeah, I guess everyone feels that way moving to New York. You're like, there's a conversation happening and like everyone's like, it was better before. And then you have to like perpetually be like, it used to be better. So that's how I felt. So in that sense, like, you know, just like a performance nerd trying to figure out all that I could. And I was first exposed to Sarah's work through like the at the Walker Art Museum, Philip Byther has an interview series with all of the commissioned artists. And I just like, you know, have watched every single one like pretty devotedly. That was like, I cite that as like such a big part of my dance and performance education. And then came across like, I think there's 3 interviews with Sarah over the 3 commissions that she did at the Walker. And that was when I was first exposed to the work. So that's how I became slightly aware. And then coming across this book at Light Industry, I guess, like as y'all spoke to, like the lack of images is very striking to know that there's like a book about choreography or performance that's just, you know, text. And then reading the book, I just like fell in love with some of the descriptions of the work and some of the tales from her collaborators. And just since then on, like I always cited Sarah jokingly as like my favorite artist whose work I've never seen. But just like the book was just like a really big like yeah, like introduction to what can't be described, which is like these live experiences. So that was like, and I maybe saw the book in maybe 2021-ish, I think is when I like found the book, read the book.
It's really interesting to hear. I mean, so I, a lot of the book, if you haven't read it, is about audience and about like who you make work for, essentially. There's a really extended argument about just like that the audience is itself like, I mean, it seems so obvious, but like if you don't have an audience that's like really paying attention, whose expectations you can be upending, then the work is not going to evolve. If it's just for like, quote unquote, you or something, it's just you're not going to go anywhere. You have to constantly have, even if it's an imaginary, but like some kind of interlocutor that's forcing you to like redo what you're doing. So when I made this, I didn't really know who the audience was for me, the people who was dedicated to, which was like my partners at the time, my friend Kim, Sarah. And I was like, and I hope that there will be an audience later, but I can't. It did, but again, because there wasn't a launch event, it didn't really have a life that I felt at the time. And I was like, well, maybe it'll have an audience later. So it's cool. That's like, it's just to me, I'm like, wow, that happens. Like it actually, you create the conditions and maybe somebody picks it up and then you're writing to that person you don't know yet. And it's just like it's very like sweet and gratifying to know that it hit with you.
Yeah, audience community. I was just looking at, on page 80, this quote you cite Sarah saying, the work is only important because of a relationship to its viewership and to the discursive relationship that you have with who matters to you. And then you later comment that their worth emerges, the worth of the work emerges from their place in a super specific web of people is not for just anyone, but for those who matter, the devoted, going back to Sarah's devotion series. And I feel like that really speaks to like, what you're saying about audience and community and like the real just importance of that. I feel like I call 99 Canal the Dime Square Art Center in this way of like this like weird like sort of like you know, weird place like you know, dedicated to the performance and film, but like the cool kids spot. And in that way, like the people who have gathered here today, I feel like it's also like another reflection of the devoted, of people who are like just devoted to performance and art. And in that way, I feel like you speak to that really clearly in this collection of essays and speaking in reflection to Sarah's work in a way that meant a lot to me.
Yeah, I mean, devotion is like, I mean, that's, I mean, the body of work that this really pivots around is this series that Sarah did called Devotion, starting in like 2012, I believe. And the word devotion, like what that's about, like is part of what I'm trying to unpack into this, like, what does it even mean to be devoted? Like, how does one become a devoted audience? What is the quality of devotion? Like, how does that like change the work? And to do that also, I mean, there are other essays in the book, and I was trying to get other, like the voices of her community in there, because I was like, these are the devoted. I want their voices in there too. It can't just be mine. And like very notably Ralph Lemon, who's such an incredible artist and writer.
And writer, piece, yeah.
His piece.
Amazing. Yeah.
Such a tear.
really good.
And I'm actually, so you said that there was a relationship between B-Sides, this piece that he wrote in the book, and Minor B, this piece that you made. And I'd be curious to hear about that.
Yeah.
It was a piece that you showed at the Shed this last summer.
Yeah, this August. Yeah. Yeah, I made a play called Minor B, and I read this essay maybe like 3 years ago, but like I completely just like restaged this essay like without subconsciously knowing it, in a way of like when something is so white it becomes black, and like this
yeah, can you speak a bit more about what
that means,
Ralph Lemon?
Yeah. Oh, what he says, I guess. Yeah. I get this is so strange talking about this with Sarah in the room, but like, she's like not like a person who knows about this much more than my uninformed reflections,
because just also like as a bit of backstory, Ralph Lemon was invited at MoMA to curate a series of performances with other choreographers called Some Sweet Days, and he and Sarah was one of the choreographers he invited. So he speaks about that experience.
And he shares in the essay that there was a secret prompt to all of the participants to respond to maybe the prompt was black music, or maybe it was specifically the blues, I don't remember. But somewhere in there, I'm like so committed to like quotations right now, I don't know why. But yeah, he just goes on this whole rant around like, you know, to every B-side there's an A-side, or to every A-side there's a B-side, and like speaking about black fugitivity and like citing a lineage of artists who are engaged in fugitive practice and citing that as blackness, and then goes on to compare Sarah to that of a black radical tradition. The whitest choreography I've ever seen, a new black, he says, a Brit with soul. And in that way, like, I was making this play called Minor B. The actual plot of it has like nothing to do with this at all, but just like was thinking about the notion of the B-side, the sort of the negative of a thing, like if there's a positive, what is the negative? And then also thinking about, as I said, like my love letter to like this community and tradition of artistry that I only know about through word of mouth and like, you know, archives, but I'm not like an archival nerd, like going to Fails archive, like looking for shit. It's just like what I, you know, what gets to me and like what I hear about through hearsay. And it's just like a love letter to what I call like, yeah, the white downtown avant-garde of the early 2000s, because I just feel like I have this like convinced notion that it was better then. I have no idea why I'm really convinced about this, and maybe some people in the room were there and could be like, no, it was broke, it was bad, our artist fees were $100, it was bad. But it just seems like the work was getting made and it looked like really a fun time. People were touring works, like, whoa, that's crazy.
Yeah.
So in that way, I just felt like I was like trying to pay homage to like that by casting this actor, Jim Fletcher, who has also appeared in Sarah's work, and like notably in the premiere of the Devotion works at The Kitchen, playing like a canonical male figure, playing Adam. I'm recasting him as like, you know, my love interest, who's actually a board member at The Shed. But then also, that's also a Sarah reference in its way of like, you know, folding in the sort of like institutional staff into the frame of the thing, of the critique. Like, we are all players in this thing, like no one is spared. Mm-hmm. And then more specifically, a portrait that I commissioned of Jim that is very much like, again, subconscious, but I think the portrait was more conscious, but like, just like maybe like a reference to daylight somewhere, that Sarah uses portraiture a lot in her work, and like large portraits of curatorial staff, dancers, and things like that. So my collaborator Dyer, who's sitting here, made this amazing charcoal portrait of Jim Fletcher. And in this way, that's just like a random aside about that work, but in the way that like, you know, and over the course of the year, I guess I got to know Sarah more as a friend this year. I mean, we actually met in the piece for no reason. I don't know why I called her out in this piece for no reason. The first time Sarah saw my work was at Judson like a year and a half ago. And I went on this long tirade about listing like old white artists. And I was just like, Sarah Mitchison, I was like, I don't know why I put you after Nature Theater of Oklahoma. I was like, Nature Theater of Oklahoma, you're dying. Oh, no. Sarah Mitchison, you're dying, and I'm so much alive. I am so much alive. Beth Gill, you're dying, and I'm so much alive. Sarah, I love you, and you're dying, and I am so much alive, and I'm so much alive. And then she was there that night, and that was like the first evening like we met, but I don't know why I went on that tangent.
That's a great tangent. I was watching the video of Minor B this morning, and like I wasn't there for the actual performance. So like a lot of these things, you catch it in these other afterlives, many of which are completely just like terrible versions of
a shell of what the actual thing is.
But if you go in knowing that it's a shell, you can kind of take out the stuff that you need. But I saw the portrait of Jim Fletcher on the wall, and I was like, wait, this is daylight. I was like, what? I was like, and I actually had like this total, because in daylight, yeah, there's each of the dancers has a portrait painted by Claude Wampler, this artist, it's just like a stunning backdrop. And I was like, duh, 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 duh. And I was like, oh, you haven't seen the work, but you got it from the text.
Yes.
And I think that's so cool. It was just like,
no, I'm curious what like Sarah would feel about that. But you actually speak about the works pretty objectively, you can't really,
them, like, really
subjectively to you, but like, yeah, maybe for my like readers ear, quite objectively, like this is what you experienced of what happened. Like the things that sit out in my memory the most when I first read it, and I always cite it many, many times or bring it up in conversations, how you describe Shadow Man at The Kitchen. And I don't know why, like I just have such a strong image from my head. It's only a paragraph of text that you wrote around like Sarah flipping the audience. The audience is facing the door, and then the closing gesture of the girls getting into the white limousine, driving east, and that being very important because the next part two was on the east side of town, and like that limousine image, like it's like sticks in my head as if I saw that work, but I completely didn't. And it's, but that's what I think is so beautiful about it. And it feels like the lack of images in the book, I didn't know the story behind the why of the lack of images, but it was clearly quite intentional to me that the words and the descriptions and the sort of associations you can draw up from the text and the hearsay of it all will be more potent than any image could ever try to approximate about these, like, this canon of work.
It's so cool to hear that. I mean, it's cool to hear that that hits because it was so, so, so intentional. I was talking with my friend Hannah, who's a beautiful writer sitting over there, about basically thick description and about like the power of thick description, like how if you like describe something properly, you don't even necessarily need to like theorize or say something else about it. Like it can like in the way in the way you articulate it, it can actually just say everything you need to say it if like you do it right. And I was really dedicated to like getting that description right, just enough information, the right details to like give you the something that approximates the after image I had in my head of it, which came a lot out of event writing, basically, which we talked about, Jeanette and I. Like, there was like a period of my life where I was basically a party reporter, and it was actually an incredibly useful experience because I had to like describe like parties and events like the night after and like give like a flair, you know, like I had to like give people a feeling of what it was, and that was definitely what allowed me to do some of the descriptions that I was doing of the work. And it's something also just doesn't exist in a lot of dance writing. Like that was, a lot of this book is me being like, fuck you to a lot of other dance writing. I was like, why do I not get really crisp descriptions of what's going on that are also informed by like the history of these movements? And like, I was just like, I wanna see this. And I also wanna be able to connect it to like bigger ideas. Yeah, thank you. So it was like me being like, how do I do this thing I just don't see in other places? But it starts with these like, how do I actually just like describe what the hell I've experienced for somebody to pick up on later? And I didn't know if it was doing that, but it did that, which sure seems like for you.
Definitely did. Why does dance writing suck right now so badly?
It's not just now. It's, I mean, well, it's, I mean, it's a little bit of a, also I don't read enough dance writing now to know if it sucks or not.
Does it exist? Anyone? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, people are publishing books about dance all over.
Okay, I was so glad.
Yes, is it economically supported?
No. Okay. I thought this book was the only one. I know, well, we have the PJ, of course, which is doing that work, but like, routine, and like, yes, like, essays about, but like, routine sort of
does
like.
Distributed art publishers release or promote books about dance? No. Like, is that a mechanism by which art texts get distributed all over the world and in the eyes of like cultural consumers and curatorial blah, blah, blah? Yeah. And does dance fall out of that? For sure. But I don't think you can make statements that all dance writing sucks right now.
I mean, I think what I say is like what I was actually referring to is not dance writing, but like.
And every dance text begins with some like prelude to how it's so hard to write about dance.
And maybe I was thinking more specifically around like, for lack of like, you know, press coverage or like writing, like routine coverage of performances that are happening in real time. Less so like critical writing about dance. There's so many scholars who are definitely doing that work.
But it takes a lot of work. Takes a lot of work. A lot of the audiences for this work, I mean, so the problem with like a lot of academic writing about dance is that the audiences are not necessarily, so the weird thing about this, if I can just like be, is that I came out of like an academic realm, but then I also hit like, I like became a reporter basically. So it was marrying these things that I think, like I had in my head both the scholarly realm and the like daily journalist realm. And I was like, okay, there's a way to bring these two things together. But if you're siloed, if you're just speaking to like the newspaper audience, or if you're just speaking to the academic audience, you are not getting the full flavor of like what is possible with writing about this stuff, essentially. So I think that that's what I would say about why does dance writing suck. It's just like specific. It's just specific for its audience, and a lot of the time, it's not trying to invent a new audience for what it's doing. I think maybe, if I was gonna respond to your question in like a serious way.
But I also, I mean, what you're also saying is, you know, you're writing about a time-based thing. You're writing about, you know, something that's happening over time. If you have a visual art background, you're not taught, you know. I also spoke to, you know, Rosalie Goldberg very much famously also always says this, like, we're not really taught to think about art as a time-based thing, to kind of like think through that in that way. I feel like a lot of writers also like kind of lean on theory or like kind of references that makes it very hard to access a work, actually, if you already like don't catch certain references. Like for me too, like this was such a good introduction because I felt like I wasn't like, how do you say that? You really like you're able to like really take someone into the work without leaning on those references, not leaning on images. And I saw the Ralph Lemon book actually, so that the other one from that series, and a lot of images in that. So it's a very, very different book. I do also like, I was wondering because you invited other writers as well, and not everyone has a background as a writer. I think someone danced with Sarah. How did you choose the other writers in that sense? Do you feel like?
I wanted one person essentially from different. So like, again, one of the things that's so fascinating about Sarah's work is that it considers every element, like every detail of the place is touched, every detail of the institution is touched. So it's keeping everything in the frame. And I wanted to get like somebody who danced with Sarah, so Greg Zuccolo. I wanted to get somebody who was like a like reporter, like a Times reporter, Gia Corliss. I wanted to get somebody who had curated, so Deborah Singer. Ralph Lemon, who's like a colleague. You know, I wanted to get different, like a spectrum of people who had encountered the work at these different levels. But I also was like, wanted good writers. So, you know, Greg's a great writer. He's such a good writer. His piece kicks off the book and it's just like, bam. Ralph, such an incredible writer. Like, so part of that was just who can actually write, which is, you know, that's something that you have to think about as an editor. It's not necessarily common to get people who can like speak. Well, I mean, good writing is basically honest writing, and so many people are taught to lie in their writing, basically. It's like this weird thing that you have to erase with people, and it's really hard to erase. But some people are better at being honest in their writing than others. And I chose people I thought could do that.
So, I mean, what was the invitation like, or cues, or?
I was like, hi, can you write about Sarah's work? I don't know, I did want, like some people, like Gia writes about stuff that I didn't see. Like it was just stuff before I came around. So, you know, I wanted them to write about things that they were in their view that I couldn't cover in my like bigger essay that was like doing this other kind of work. But I don't know. It was just like, that was pretty like standard, I think.
I have a super mundane question. How long did it take you to write this essay, Split City?
That was probably written over like the course of 2 years, I think. It started as a piece in Art Forum.
When did you start writing it?
I want to say 2015. And so like a short portion of it is this piece that was in the magazine in Art Forum, and then I just expanded beyond that over the course of like a year or so, year and a half. But I mean, the whole book probably took like 1,000 hours or more. I don't know, it was like a really, I was trying to with Hannah earlier, I went to on my old computer and was like trying to go through all the like folders I had, and I was like, oh my god, I watched this video of Shadow Man that I had, I'm sure, like 100 hours. I would like put it, I like.
A video of what?
I got like a video, I got like a bootleg video of Shadow
Man. What?
I ripped it from the CD, or DVD, because this was like on a DVD at the time. I like then ported it to my phone, which in that moment was like not easy. But, and then I would like sit on the subway and every day I went to work, I would watch it again and again and again. Just to like be like, wait, that gesture. Like I was like, how, and that was the thing. I was like, okay, the scooping gesture that's happening at this particular moment at like minute 59. I was like, I wanna know how she made that decision. What were the conditions that made that decision? Like, can I fantasize this world in which like I can like understand that decision being made and how it relates to all these other decisions? Like, can I like create this environment for like getting a sense of the meaning of that gesture?
In that process, were you and Sarah talking about the work, or it was very much you, your experience?
It was me, my experience. I was like, I don't think I was talking much with Sarah about these things. I did a conversation with Sarah early on, but like we weren't, and Sarah's pretty private about a lot of these things. So even if I had specific questions about why something was there or not, like I don't think that she would give me much to work with. So yeah, it was just a lot of detective work and total fantasizing. I mean, like, I don't like actually pretend that this is what the work is. I'm like, this is very much like my deeply informed, but like very partial take on like what Sarah's work meant in this moment. And there's a lot of things that are like still very unexplored or that get like, you get a taste of the question of blackness in the work that like Ralph Lemon raises, and which also interestingly in an Easter egg, Jeremy O'Harris raises in the very last like couple pages of the book. He's like this kid. So it's like, there's a conversation that the book ends with. And it's just Jeremy is just Jeremy. But he's just like asks, he's like, Ralph Lemon says, your work is black. And like, what does that mean? And Sarah's like, I don't know. Like, basically. But, you know, it's like, it's a really interesting question that gets, that's in there slightly. Like, Ralph is basically like, it's black because I say so, and because it's oppositional, and because it's like born of this like lower class Mancunian British thing that like resembles something that I recognize more than like lower class, like American whiteness or something. There's a lot of class stuff in the book that gets tied in. Like I can talk about class, but like race gets like put in this like, this like a smaller way that would be really interesting to have unpacked. And like, there's like a whole other book that could be done about that.
Mm-hmm. Did you always have such like a deep knowledge of like modern dance history, or was that something that formed in research for this book? Because you're like, you bring it to Balanchine and Dunham and all of these folks that, I mean, I don't have that particular lineage of knowledge, but you really do a beautiful, you know, it's part, such a part of Sarah's work, is like these dance histories and legacies. Was that a part of your like knowledge set or?
No, I didn't study any of this stuff. I mean, but I also didn't study art, and I learn whatever you can learn, you can learn anything, you know. It's just like you just go read a bunch of stuff. And
yeah, how? Like it's interesting. I mean, all of us, like I arrived here 5 years ago. I very much similar feeling. Like I, you know, grew up in the rural south of the Netherlands. Like I very much had no access to this world. You come in and you're like, how do I catch up? You know, and a lot of it is like it's maybe hidden in an archive, or maybe you get it from like talking, meeting someone at a party and speaking about it. And like, but yeah, how do you get access to this information? How do you inform yourself to this history? Because, you know, there isn't that much.
You go to stuff like this, you like read books, you see a lot, you just go in. I don't know, it's like you commit to the actual learning and think you can do it, and then you start doing it. I mean, I'm not like a dance scholar either. Like the stuff that I know about dance is also very partial. Like I know about Balanchine because I read a lot about Balanchine. I like picked up lots of biographies. I like read Jennifer Homans, whose book I hated, but like what was very, you know, helpful. I like dated a performance artist who like I could just talk to ad nauseum about it. Like I made friends with dancers. Like you talk to people, you read, you watch. It's just like you learn anything. It's the best way of learning. It's much better than school in that way. But yeah, I didn't know anything about dance and then I learned a lot. I don't know if I could teach a class on it, but I could teach a class on it, but I don't know if it would be like the right class.
Dance History 101 is not, yeah, no.
I really want to invite people also to like, I don't know, like ask questions or make remarks.
Yeah, I have a question.
Go on.
David, you said you saw three times in a row this performance. I wonder if you could characterize what it is that you saw and you felt like. Because I think of like the first time I saw Fina Bausch or something, and could feel that this vernacular, some Paul vernacular and dance that I'd never seen before. And there's images I can recall. Can you categorize the images that you saw those three times of energy coming back?
I saw a closeness among the dancers. I saw it was these four dancers, Mike Iveson, Greg Ziegler, Parker Lutz, and Sarah at Performance Space, and they were so. It's not that they were in sync in like a like actual literal way, but there was like a rhythm to how their bodies were connecting that like I was like, oh, they are like soak floats. And there was something about the quality of that closeness that I just was like, I want, and how they were like moving on stage together. It was just, it was like weird. It was this kind of like middle class, earnest, not earnest. It was like all these weird, dance moves juxtaposed with like this soundtrack that was like mixes of it starts off okay actually it starts off it's like the most beautiful beginning ever. She has a live band playing Baker Street by Jerry Rafferty, and they play it twice in a row. They're like hidden beneath these like risers, I believe, and the band, and it's like the first 15 minutes of the dance, or just this live, kind of like good but not good, like live version of Baker Street, and the dancers like coming out and doing this dance with this crazy lighting, and you're like, what is happening? It's like beautiful but like wrong, and it's held together by like the way that you can see that these people are like family in this way, and it's like a family that's like. I don't know, you can just tell that there's like something maybe about to like break up about it, or there's something, it's like on this particular part of his journey. And I just like fell in love with them. I fell in love with it. I was like attached to like what was happening. And yeah, I saw that two more times. And then I just became like religiously devoted. Like I would fly wherever there was a Sarah, like if Sarah was doing something at the Walker, I would like go there and see everything. I would see it multiple nights. I like remember this trip. I was like had to be in Switzerland. There's like this very potent memory of being in Switzerland at Art Basel for my job. And I hated Art Basel. It was just market, pure market. And Sarah was premiering Dover Beach at the Kitchen. And I used frequent flyer miles to fly back to catch the premiere. And then I was in New York for like 18 hours and I flew back to Basel to like do the rest of the fair. But I was like, I can't miss this performance. This is actually what matters. It's not tied to a market. It's like just like doing it for like the love. I mean, and this is the fucked up and like also beautiful thing about dance and poetry and like a lot of forms that there's no market for, is that like if you're in it, you're really not in it to make any money. And so that's, it keeps it clean in this way. That's also brutal. But it like, in contrast to what I was doing with the art market at the time, I was just like, I have to be here. This is like what matters. And so there was something too about that, I think, that was just connecting to what it was about that was so different from the world that I was in, that I was like being paid to do.
I have a question for the room a little bit. We can talk about the book, which is talking about the work, but I know I see, I would never put Sarah on the spot, but I know I see
Why
these
not?
Three, because respect your elders. But I do see at least three folks in the room who have danced for Sarah or collaborated with Sarah, and I would love, if interested, I would love to hear an anecdote or any thoughts or feelings around what it felt like or meant to you to collaborate with Sarah, if you feel comfortable doing so. Putting you very much on the spot, John and Mariah. I don't know, I feel like we can opaquely talk about a book, but I'm like, I want to go to the source.
Yeah, of course.
Let's go to the source. I can read the essay.
Yeah, I mean, the book's
here. I know that John did a really good somersault, but I need more.
The first time I saw John was in this piece, Devotion Study of God. What was it? Devotion Study number 4 at the Whitney. And I was like, and he came out on the stage and I was like, what the fuck? Who is this? Like, he's like such a fucking, like, genius mover. And then he was in this other piece, Tornamento, and I was like, he's captivating. And yeah, I don't know, what was it like? Why did you get into Sarah's work? I am gonna put you up.
John is like,
I mean, I don't know, I feel like I'm here to listen, here to why we're gathering here today to talk about the book, and yeah, I wanted to like show up and tune into that. But I don't know, I don't really feel super available to talk about all that. I think that's probably some combination of like my own stuff and my relationship with Sarah and yeah, I don't know. I mean, such an important part of the work, if I can speak on behalf of the works that I was a part of, was kind of like being there and witnessing them live. I think that has a relationship to probably the image question around the book. And yeah, I don't know, I don't feel super available to like,
you've already shared a lot.
That's a lot.
Well, yeah, but I'm not talking about like what it was like.
Oh yeah, I have to be like what it's like. I just wanted to hear any thought.
What was it like to read the book? Did you read the book?
I did read the book.
Oh, that's a better question.
Read the book. It was fun to read the book.
That was right.
Yeah. Not articulated. It was like anybody who goes into any process with any artist has limited access to what the history of the body of work was before you joined. I think that's pretty universal. And so through the book to kind of get more context, you're hearing more stories, points of view on aspects of the history or the body of work that happened before I came into it, was valuable and interesting.
Thanks, John.
Thank you, John.
Can I ask Mariah how you first encountered Sarah's work?
I first encountered Sarah's work I saw Jogo Reach. And I don't remember what year was that, Sarah? Like 2010? Yeah. I didn't even know Sarah yet. I had just moved to Milan as well. And I was somehow friends with Tragil I was doing PJ's performance journal stuff with Tragil. And anyway, he was like, Mari, you have to go see there. I'm out of town, you have to go. So then I was like trying to go, and then there were like no tickets because it sold out. And I remember I got Kitchen like really early so I could make sure I got in. And I think I was like, you know, I got there like really, I don't know, it was like 2 hours or something crazy. And they were still rehearsing, and you could hear the music. And like, I was waiting in the lobby, the chance, and they're hearing the distance. And then I saw Sarah and a few other concepts.
Lots of other contacts. Many other contacts.
Lots of other places. But that's a very good time to saw the work. And I was really into the work because I thought, like, I thought it was a kind of like feminist takedown on ballet in a really specific way that was very interesting and kind of deconstructing that history. In a, like another system of semiotics and like major artists like Forsyth or someone who have also like taken on the history of ballet and deconstructed it, but like from another point of view. And yeah, I mean, I was like riveted by the work. And but I don't think I ever talked to Sarah until we got into an argument around questions of authorship, Tumpkin, also because I'm fragile. So,
ready?
Yeah. It's like in one of like these like Judy's like platform things, like the dance based platforms things. When Prada did that one called like Certain Difficulties, Certain Joys. In what was that? I don't know, 2011, 12, I don't know. And yeah. And then I don't even want to talk. I have no comment. I only can talk to, I'm not going to speak publicly about what it was like.
Yeah, that's a silly question. No, I like the first contact question.
I'm curious, like, how you got there.
So I was like, whatever.
Yeah. Well, but I think it's also, it's A, there's two things there I just want to pick up on. The, like, going to the performance and it sold out, like, this is a reason I wanted to do the book was because Sarah and also Ralph to some degree, especially Sarah, doesn't do repertory. So it's like you are either in New York and it's there and you're there for like the week or two it's happening and you manage to get a ticket or you just never see it. There's no record, there's nothing. And I was like, whatever, that's fine with Sarah, but it felt totally unfair to me. So I was like, there has to be something there to like live on, if nothing else, than for, just for my own gratification. But also like encountering Sarah, like all these other things, like it's about a community. It's about like showing up to stuff. Like you go to so many things. Like you are, I go out much less than I did before the pandemic, basically. Like I haven't been a part of the world in that way since then. So I'm actually so curious what the texture is of the dance world now. It feels to me like there's really cool people making things that I'm like only tuning into. But it's like you have to go to stuff. You have to be in conversation. You have to like meet people at events and have arguments. And like it's, that's like, that's how you do this. It's not just like showing up at BAM and being like, look, this person made this thing. It's like the beating heart of it is like people coming in together into small rooms and like often like having really intense polarizations around like specific questions.
Yeah, that's something that I've been making peace with more recently is like the sort of like those that know, know, and those that don't. And like that just being okay. I used to call it like an inside joke, but I like my work always has like an inside joke inside of it that like, I'm not gonna explain myself to you, but like if you like get the thing, you get the thing. Jessica was talking to me last night about it and being like, I love Jim Fletcher. And like she knew what the Jim Fletcher reference was about, but half the room probably didn't. And I'm not gonna like explain that, but I know what it meant to me and some people know, but like, and that's just, I think what makes it better than like if we're trying to like, you know, make it universal or trying to like speak to a global universal audience, but it's just being like, it's for the people in the room, for the people who are in New York those 2 weeks, for the people who are devoted audience members or community members and from different aspects from the field. And like that sort of insularity is something that I find really like comforting and like fun about it all, but I used to see it as maybe like a limitation.
Yeah, and I think that there's like, I think it's like there's a, it's understanding that like that Easter egg thing is like, it does create like an inside outside, but it also, there is something to those inside jokes that does, I think, even if you're not in the know, because of how it's like invested with this particular charm, like I think, it will emanate something for people even not in the know.
Yeah.
You know, even if they're like, why don't I understand that? That seems confusing, but there's something charismatic about that gesture that I can't put my finger on. And it's that, if you know, you know, quality. Mm-hmm. And it will attract other people, which I think is like an argument for like authorizing yourself to do that, basically.
I do want to like speak to that a bit, like, because because there are no images in this book, it made it such a special book, because Sarah doesn't allow for like any like video or whatever traveling around on her work, it makes it like kind of more
there's a mythology
yeah. But what I'm seeing too in maybe the younger generation of artists, they feel very much not in control of their image or like images that are made. How do you feel about that? Do you feel you can take control of that? Do you want to take control of that? How does that affect your work?
It's super mediated and like conscientious. Like I'm on team like not gonna ignore the media aspect of like the afterlives of the performances that I make. Like it's a part of it. So again, I embrace it, but again, like, you know, try to like, yeah, you will not find any like full works of mine like on public Vimeo. That just feels weird. But you know, certain clips, you know, I like to like, you know, little moments that I like, you know, cause you know, people gotta engage somehow. And like so much of how I've understood the ecology, like you have to, I've only seen it as like a producing reality. Like I have to share the work somehow so the work can like proliferate itself. So and for me, like sharing some videos, some images helps that for me. But I agree, like it really freaks me out that like every public program you do at any organization, like, you know, there is images and a record that is just there forever. And then all of a sudden, like you have, after like 10 years of the game, you have like quite a wealth of media around you that you did not author nor like necessarily like you consented to, yes, but like just like a swath of like you will be on that nonprofit's brochure for 5 years minimum. And you just have to be like, okay, that's just like a part of it. So like, yeah, not my fave, but I also like, you know, understand the purpose that it serves and helping these organizations like proliferate their mission and do the things that they need to do. So I don't have disdain towards it, but it's something that I try to do conscientiously or move through conscientiously, like what I share, what I don't share. But this is badass. I mean, yeah, I would love to be like, no images. But I'm not, I think if I were ever to make a monograph, I would have some images. There's some images that I quite like, that I made, that I would like to be shared. So that's where I stand.
Yeah, what would your ideal monograph look like?
Oh my God. I don't know. I mean, that. Yeah, let's manifest it. Yes, please. I would love. let me not get ahead of myself, but I don't know. Yeah, you know, thoughtful essays by people who are in the room. And then, yeah, just a couple images. Like, I feel like there's this, like, each show I have, like, I think there's, like, 3 images from each show I've made that I really, really love. Mm. And, like,
Who takes the pictures?
Whoever the theater hires. I don't have a continuity there, but a lot of the work has been photographed by Maria Baranova, who's, like, I feel like, I don't know much about Paula, sadly, but I feel like for our generation is, like, the performance photographer documenter of so many, like, yeah. So Maria Baranova does really great work and also has a beautiful portrait series, Faces of the Downtown, where she shoots like downtown artists in like medium format. That's really beautiful, of like dancers and choreographers. So I have a lot of licensing agreements to do with Miss Baranova for this monograph, this forthcoming monograph. But that's also another weird thing about the documentation imagery spirals, like who owns it, who doesn't own it, and like this weird thing around like when you add more refractions to the work in that regard, like it's further out of your hands in regards of like ownership and things like that. Like I don't own the licensing to those images. I think I have like, you know, external, like, you know, use of the images for perpetuity or et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But like if we're talking gelatin prints of the thing that's going to do the thing, like, I don't own that, but like, you know, these images that are like, you know, clearly of me, composed by me, made by me, but not. But yeah, I have a whole another rant about photography and that I'm not a fan, y'all, but I'll talk about that for another talk. I just like, yeah, photography as a medium, I have like really deep, yeah, a photographer trauma. But yeah, that's not that, but yeah, there will be images. I mean, it'll just be a monograph like any other monograph, you know, a badass introduction by someone who's like, you know, really smart and can make my nonsensical decisions sound like a part of a really thought out lineage. I don't know who that person
Someone
is though.
Like David.
Maybe. What's up, Mark? Are you about to, did you raise?
Well, I have a question.
Yeah.
Like about the book and like these like bigger questions around like how to historicize things that disappear and are tongue-based and are really hard to like put into formats of representation. Like dance is just hard to do that, even though it's constantly representing all sorts of, like it's representing in a lot of different ways that are kind of beyond language all the time. So I guess like to me, I haven't read the book.
That's okay.
So I really haven't. I haven't read Ralph's book either. I've always wanted to, but also they need to even out their gender situation there.
Is the series? The series is like kaput. Well, like this doesn't have any.
It's a triptych, and of course, like in art form dominant by women, you have Remen starring and shining. Anyway, but that's a side note. But I want to say that, like, I think that it isn't a monograph.
No.
And I guess I think that that's an important distinction to, I'd be curious to hear, like, David and Sarah, like, talk about maybe, or I don't know, is it, do you perceive it a monograph or do you not? I personally won't perceive it as a monograph because, and like, an interruption on, like, a kind of art market mechanisms of, like, we make monographs of the, like the connoisseurship habit of compiling information into retrospectives and funneling like artists' practices into product, leaving out like collaborators and then this like in the name of the signature that like happens but much in visual art, even, you know. And I don't, I would just be curious how you guys like think it, how you thought about that in relation to, was it Siri? And yeah. Like, what's its role in the, like, the game of the canon or the choreographer becoming artists, like, visual artists, which I feel like, not that they're becoming that, but the machine is placing them in that space more than the, like, there's, you know, we could look at some other mega artists who are really important, but the machine hasn't placed them in the space of the visual art canon, whereas we can say that it's kind of happened with Sarah and Ralph. I mean, maybe I'm saying something contentious by arguing that, but yeah, so I'm curious how you guys thought through that and how you, is it a monograph or not? if it isn't, were you doing it on purpose to run interference on this relationship between creation of value and capital vis-a-vis the mechanisms of the art regime and all of its publication facilities that serve a kind of a cool value and intellectual capital that is owned by certain individuals in the world, blah, 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 and what is dance doing that? And, or is it, yeah, is it perceived as a monograph and that's all that matters? Because at the end of the day, perhaps that's what it is.
It might be coy to say that it's like something a little more like juicy than a monograph. It's disguised as a monograph, but like it's, you know, like it has like the skeleton, like it has a list of works, you know, like with all the dancers, which did not exist before that, you know, and that was very important to me. That there would be like, you could pick up this book and be like, I want to know the history of Sarah's work up until this point, just from like what was shown where. It has a bibliography, you know, it has these like, the armature is there. And then, yeah, I mean, the actual texts are, I think, really unusual for the form, but like probably also the monograph as a form can't hold that. Actually, I would be maybe like thinking too highly of myself to think that I was actually like achieving something that burst that or something. It's a monograph, I think.
I don't think it's a monograph.
Say it.
And I have more to say, yes.
Tell me more.
It's not a monograph because the day that the book became itself. So first of all, I just was, obviously it wasn't the same thing. I was truly learning what to, like, I mean, as David knows, I did not want to look. Mm-hmm. We like to each other and the whole thing, but I'm wrong, where I said I don't want to learn. The book was started without my knowledge in a very confusing way that was not intentional, but that where I was doing with Paula, I was taking photos for Ralph Lennon's book and the book called Sour Sweet Day. And so she kept calling me talking about the photos for your book. Or like photos for Ralph's book, my photos for your book. And I kept thinking the Sour Sweet Day book. So I said, those photos in Maya weren't in Bill Foote's books. So it was a long time before I realized that was good. There was a book, there was a my book, and then there was all these photos in it. So then the summer we met, I was really mad. And then sort of gave it a chance. I went to the person who was making the book, Joseph, and it was like all these prints, like images and all that. I was like, literally beside myself. Like the first idea was like, oh, if you can. So then I was like, I don't want a book, no book. But then David was really, we had very candid conversations, and one of the conversations, and at first it took me a minute to get like on board because I was about to end the career. And I was like, this, this, and why is me, and I'm this. And there was a funny thing, which I was telling Maria earlier, like, there was a funny thing, like, just what happened where they printed out all these options of the cover of the book. And one of them was the ones that you was idly used, but the others, no. Four of them. And at first it was called Mohairs. And it was like big laps and mow dance. And four of the painters were of the Demi. Like, because I hadn't asked for a correction by MoMA ever. So it was all this word and I'm taking that said MoMA dance on it, which I think is one thing of will be funny. And I do sometimes regret not just like letting that slide. Anyway, so I was behind the curve, I didn't want a book. I remember being in a meeting with Kathy and I got so mad at her, but I changed my mind. There was still down at a restaurant. What has happened? And no one could understand why I didn't want one, but the way that Mary talked about the photographs is why, I don't know, I do feel that dance is very trembling and beautiful, and it's a shared experience between dancers and dance makers. And it's not that I don't care about it being represented in the canon or in the history of the art making world. Just for myself, I feel very fragile without all that, all like about. All I could trust was being on stage with my friends or being in a lot of my friends and doing that. And so I remember being in the staff cabin and she said, why are you so worried about this book? Don't be bothered. As a diva. I was like, actually, what? I can't have one book. There aren't going to be other books. Like, what do you mean this could be for us? And why are there going to be other books? Maybe they have to accept this book. Like, And so it went on and on. I was like, I don't want to. And then Dave and I it's okay to say, we had a very candid conversation. He's like, this writing that I have done, I really want to publish it. I love it. It's really beautiful. And then I said, okay, then no images. It's only black and white. The text has to be small. And we have that phrase. That was
me. We have to what?
Have phrase.
Oh, that was you that was said that. Thank you. Yeah.
So you agreed to those things.
Yeah.
And then it became what it became. But I would not have agreed to something making him a mobile was to be considered in my graph.
Totally.
But why not?
Why wouldn't I agree?
Yeah, like what is it about the format of monograph that doesn't sit right with you as an artist or possibly with like what it means to be a choreographer?
Very, very emotional. There's some way that attempts to capture something about what we're living and doing that I think immediately take something away from what we're living into. I don't know why I feel that way, but I feel that way. And that's not to say that would be the same for anyone else or everyone or something like that. Like, I just know it for myself, which is why I was had such a hard time with this whole thing, and also why I'm in a day.
Is this something about the legitimating function of what we call a monograph?
I think that's the thing. I think that the idea that, there is another issue, but I don't want to be like small-minded about this, but maybe it can help, maybe it just can. I think there is a way in which the immersive and the framing award takes ownership of it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Also,
in some way that I can't control, obviously, because you know what I mean. But
yeah. I think there was also a conversation of the many conversations we had around the like making of the book, which were like very contested in ways that like were I like love and were so hard and part of. I was like, oh my God, I'm actually working with Sarah.
Yeah, no.
I was like, this is what it's like.
A conversation like that was like, okay, so you want to know how it gets made? This is how it gets made.
Yeah.
It isn't like, oh, we just like rush it out and decide that this is how it gets made. It isn't this hard.
Yeah. And I was, and I think part of it was that MoMA was doing it. I think you were also at some point, you were like, what if we do somebody, if somebody else does it?
Yeah.
And I was like, well, MoMA, who is paying for, yeah, I was like, this is like, these are the institutional things that like, this is the invitation, this is the funding. But he's used to it.
No, I do. I really do. No, I do. But there was a funny moment when I was in the room with the, I guess it's the guys they were published in by.
Oh.
Yeah. And when they were like, I was like, you know that MoMA hasn't commissioned you, right? Like, these works are all of me. It's like, it was like, and at the desk, the publisher was like, oh, you know, because they couldn't understand why I didn't want it. I was like, so anyway.
And I was like trying to sneak it in the back row. I was like, okay, here's an opportunity. I was like, here's somebody who's going to pay for it to be printed. I'm like, I'm just going to like figure out how to like weave it into this thing.
I do really want to say, like, just on the back end, I just had this frozen scene with MoMA, and I have never been so well treated. Like,
yes, give it up for MoMA.
I'm not lying.
Yeah.
I was really moving and
right of large in this.
Yeah.
Others, structure of the canon, all that. I'm just the people ourselves.
But I feel like at some point, too, you relented, or there was like a shifting point when I was like,
when
this is my work.
This is my writing.
Yeah, I was like, this is my work. I was like, this isn't your work.
Then I was like, okay, then it has to stand on its own.
Yeah.
Yes.
Totally.
Then
and that was.
What it is.
Yeah.
Then
So I guess in a way that squashes the monograph question, because I guess like the monograph is like a display of work or works, and like there is no display of your work in this book. There's display of David's writing, which are reflections on your work, but your work is not in the book.
And it's different than the other books in that regards, and that's why it is a funny, like, Ralph and Boris were, like, very on board and very collaborative with their editors because they did want to participate in the system in that way. And that this was part of this family of books makes it kind of, like, it's such a weird, uneasy relationship because it's not like them, and it's not like them because of the character of your work and our conversation, but it does... It like fucks with that line. But I'm like, I don't want to say it's not a monograph because it feels pretentious to me to be like, it's not a monograph, it's something cooler. But I, low key, I do think it's true. It's just like, it's my work and I managed to package it in this way that could like live in the world through this other route.
Was Study 3 not a commission by MoMA?
It was Ralph. Yeah. Yeah, so it wasn't like a curator, it wasn't like a MoMA curator coming in, it was like Ralph being like, you. Yeah.
I have a question about the performance documentation. I mean, there's a lot of comments about, you know, we talk with Greer about it, and how you don't really have much license for some of the photos. Actually, immediately you do have a license, because opposition is shared, and what you're doing today is considered derivative, so her work is actually included in the book. So I'm concerned whether this piece is considered a documentation on a derivative work, or is there shared authorship? What's going on? Because I see a little gray space here, and maybe wants it to be like really inconclusive. But at the end of the day, we still have a material object against all the artist's wishes, per se, or not. I don't know. So I just wanted to know if you could illuminate on that.
Whether it's derivative, or I mean, where the derivative in the sense that it's like born out of something else.
But it would derivative in the most like basic literal sense. So when you render a performance, you try to register the performance work, you have to basically provide derivative. You can't actually provide the performance to register the performance documentation. And what you're doing actually would technically be considered a document. You could register because you listed the formalism, listed all the technical details, and also like literally what happens in a objective context. So I wanted to know about whether it's Felix to share authorship, just what would it put in that?
I think it's, that's such a good question, and I don't know where authorship, I mean.
Yeah, we have to like define authorship.
It's
like, cause like,
I wouldn't have ended up publishing the book if Sarah hadn't finally agreed to like say, this is your thing, go ahead and do it. So in that sense, I feel like she was like, if it's yours, then okay. In that case, maybe it's my ownership. Authorship, but I'm also like not so, except for maybe like legal reasons, I guess, or like reasons of like how you distribute resources or something. I don't know that I'm even so concerned with the question of like who is authoring this thing that came out, like, or I think that like, the parts of myself that authored it and the parts of Sarah that authored it like are their own entity that don't necessarily exist in one individual. So it's like until like the location of authorship in an individual is already speaking to this like legal framework that like I don't consent to. But that's a little bit of a dodge, but I also don't know how to answer the question.
Let that send her both.
I think of this book as being like the premise of the end of Sarah Mitchelson, but this book is actually about writing. Like this book is about being a writer and like why you have to write. And this then, this like this artwork becoming a part of you. And like it, then that's its own thing, I think. Like I think Sarah Mitchelson, it's almost like, you could always put in quotes on that.
That would have been a Sarah.
Relationship to it, but the parts it is like if it comes and it comes out.
It's like my George Miles cycle or something.
Yeah, but that, yeah, that's what I identify.
I think this is a beautiful way to end the conversation.
Yeah.
I am really glad that all of you showed up and everyone who shared. I think these are the difficult conversations we need to be having. So thank you. Yeah.